You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Serena Locke. The devastating floods that hit northwest Queensland in February caused significant economic damage for communities, with estimates nearing $2 billion in lost stock and infrastructure. Monsoonal rains with floods and driving wind affected some 10 million hectares. That's almost twice the size of Tasmania. And right in the path was the Harrington family's station, Brainard. It's 140 kilometres north of Julia Creek, and it's in the catchment of the Flinders River, which grew to be a vast inland sea at the height of the flood, spanning some 80 kilometres wide in parts. They've been there for 81 years this October, and while it's all cattle now, it was once the most northernmost sheep station in Australia. Scott Harrington and his son Beau sat down with Ali Felton-Taylor and described what their work has been like since the nightmare.
As soon as it dried out enough and we could move, we started assessing what had to be done and got to areas where we could put some fencing up to try and keep the few cattle we had left behind wire.
You've spent a bit of time on a grader. What have you observed?
Well, we've got roads that have been in the same position and used for trucking cattle in and out for excess of 40 years that now don't exist there, like little streams. So about 20-odd k's of new road has to be built and also repairs to all the other roads. But our country has grown, definitely, but there's big areas of erosion and big areas of silt, but it's still nice to see some good green grass.
Yeah, what about pasture response? Is obviously it's a big property, so varied across different country types, but what typically has it been like?
This rain event lasted for a week, and we had a year and a half's rain in a week, of which half of that fell in one day. So the country's probably responded remarkably well, considering the rain event that we had.
Bo, obviously, in terms of cleaning up, there's been more than just grading being done. A heck of a lot of steel pegs and wires been rolled out through this country. I can't even begin to imagine how many steelies have been hammered in. What have you been up to?
The last few weeks, the water has receded in the low-lying areas in the creeks and flood crossings, so we're slowly getting to those areas, and we've been really putting a dent in it, thankfully. Water infrastructure, as the water holes are drying back in those areas, we're trying to get to them and resurrect them to make them serviceable. We've still got a few to go, but I think we've still got a few weeks of water holes and surface water in those areas. We'll get to them in the near future.
What about mustering?
Logistically, got to get some more fences and waters finished first, but I'm hoping to get stuck into some cattle work a couple of weeks after Easter, and we'll be able to really start to take note of the damage done, what we have left. But a few weeks before we start, still we've got to keep the cattle in mind. They've been through a bit of a traumatic period, so a few extra weeks before we start doing much, I think we'll do them the world of good as well.
It's a busy period of fencing and repairing roads in far north Queensland around Julia Creek, where flood wreaked havoc 2 months ago. And as you'll hear, they're appreciative of the help they've had from across Australia. Keeping the cattle nurtured with feed is vital before they start mustering, and only then will they know how many cattle they have left. Beau and his dad, Scott Harrington, will then have to decide how many cattle they'll need to restock. They're speaking here with Ali Felton-Taylor.
In waiting to see how well our country develops in growth, some of our country had more rain from Trevor, so it's going to respond a lot better.
Is there a sense of anxiousness that you might miss out on cheaper cattle?
The market's been floating up and down. There's been extreme cases within 300 k's of us. We've been nearly washed away on the first instance at the beginning of February, and then other places have had another really big hit when Trevor came through, Cyclone Trevor. And then you've only got to go a little bit further west from here into the Barkly Tablelands, and there, the dead opposite, they're really, really dry. And there's cattle coming out of that country into this country. And as far as the markets, I think we've got to look after our cattle and be prepared to get our cattle and look on a long-term basis.
Beau Harrington, back to you. What about planning for a natural disaster? Is that an unreasonable expectation?
I think planning for this one, we do certain things leading into every wet season, and if we had known what was ahead of us 3 weeks out, there wasn't a lot we could have done to make the situation or the outcome any better going through it. So that has been comforting to know, and if anything, for me personally, not having been through a flood of this size, if anything, it's given me a reason as to some of our management techniques and our methods. more so than planning for one in the future, I'd say.
Scott Harrington, you've been through, you were alive certainly in 74 when that dreadful flood happened. It was a more widespread event, not as targeted as this perhaps. There was Cyclone Ted, certainly cattle deaths then. What are some of the key points in terms of resilience, do you think? Is it something that you've clocked, or is it more a matter of getting through it and getting things done?
Ali, there's been a lot of natural disasters come through in all areas of Australia, and I think they call it the land of extremes, and it's pretty right. As far as setting yourself up, it's very difficult. Obviously, if you've been around for a little bit longer, and I was very fortunate enough to have a father before me that was very supportive, and he'd been through some tougher times, and I suppose you build your own resilience against difficult times. But probably the strongest thing that's happened to me is we're a family group. I've got three children and my wife, and we've worked together, and it's been that's probably been the solidest thing that I can say for me personally. And our neighbours, our district, and the general public have been overwhelmingly supportive in more ways than you can ever imagine. And that goes to people in Victoria, South Australia, the offers and things that have turned up in the mail. It's just blowing us out. We've had boxes of gear turn up from people that we don't know, and it's like a mob of kids when you come home from fencing to sit around and open it up and see what's in it. And it's probably the positive side of human nature in Australia that's really come out. It's actually, a lot of us cannot get over how generous people have been.
Bo Harrington, over to you. Obviously, people in agriculture, rural people, have a reputation for being tough and resilient. But a layperson might ask you, as a young person in a business, what keeps you staying on the land?
Certainly, some of the big reasons are my family's here, and you have to love what you do, and thankfully I do. Community as well. It plays a very important part for me personally, and also I think there's tremendous opportunity here for the right person with the right attitude.
Scott Harrington, speaking of community, there are plenty of events up here that bring people together, but just up in your district, what are some of the important things? I'm thinking of perhaps Sedan Dip. The infrastructure there was really badly damaged, but how important will that gathering be to people in your neck of the woods?
Things like Sedan Dip and Saxby Roundup and the Dirt and Dust in Julia Creek, they're massively important. They've become a bit iconic. They're drawing tourists, and most of it is done by voluntary labour or voluntary workers from the local area. And it's a sense of ownership of the events and pride. Getting back to Sedan Dip, our family's been involved with that since it started about 70 years ago, and we're still very heavily involved with that. It's a strong community. Yeah, the gear has been damaged a little bit, but it'll up and run again this year. It's got a date on the calendar in the middle of August. People will pull together and it'll be a good weekend.
How do you feel on reflection of the way your community, Northwest Queensland's, responded?
I can probably only speak for myself there, Ali, but I'm tremendously proud of the way that the local communities and even the broader, you know, the whole nation, how they've responded to it. I think it's really reinstalled my confidence in our industry and our region, and you realise that we're not alone here. You know, the rest of the nation is behind us, and so yeah, I've been tremendously proud about that.
Scott and Bo Harrington from Brainard Station, Julia Creek in North Queensland, with our reporter Ali Felton-Taylor. Life for the Hick family on their station Argyle, just north of Julia Creek, is slowly getting back to normal, but it's been an enormous amount of work with help from friends, family and strangers. Reporter Ali Felton-Taylor sat down with Patrick and Edwina Hick, and while it's still very raw, let's hear what Patrick Hick told ABC News 2 months ago.
I guess we want to get out the message, the enormity of it, of what has happened, the enormity of livestock loss. Unless you're here on the ground, it is very hard to comprehend it. Cattle are in really poor condition from being in the mud and so forth for days on end. They're really lame. They're shell-shocked. We're finding cattle. We're flying every day. I'm going out in a helicopter checking cattle. We're finding cattle sitting up on ridges surrounded by all their dead mates, rotting carcasses. They could walk 200 metres to green grass and water, and they won't. They're shell-shocked. Cattle are acting, they're not acting normally to me. I've been around cattle all my life, and they're shell-shocked. They won't go out in the mud. You can't make them go out in the mud.
So, Patrick Hick, it's been some 8 weeks now since that was going on. I can't even describe what it would have been like for you since that 8 weeks. What has rebuilding looked like?
Oh, well, all our fences are back up again, and we've started the process of mustering and seeing what is left.
Have you calculated what you've lost at this stage? I mean, you haven't done all your mustering, but have you got a sense?
We haven't done all our mustering, and our neighbours haven't, so there's more cattle to come back, we hope. But I made an estimation very early on that we would have lost about 6,000 head, and I'm not going to be too wrong.
In the process of rebuilding fences, how's that been? You said they're all done now.
They are. We had sort of three teams operating, two of our own plus a contractor, and we had pretty remarkable help from people, associates, friends, strangers who just turned up and gave us a hand for a while, so it was quite remarkable.
We'll get to that generosity. That seemingly has been in a really amazing part of what's happened up here. What about the country? What the countries looked like? Obviously, it was an immense amount of rain. Indeed, an amount that you probably couldn't even calculate, because when it goes over the rain gauge, it's hard to tell how much rain there has been. What's that been like?
Oh, very disappointing. The response, the feed response has been quite disappointing. Unless country picked up a second hit of rain out of Trevor, then it's responded well. But if it only had that one hit, very disappointing.
So what do you think's happened there? I mean, an awful amount of rain. Did it fall and then pool, or was there not sort of the grass seed there?
Well, the grass seed was there. It's just that it was a huge amount of rain in a short window, so we might as well have only counted 8 or 10 inches of it. The rest of it's water on water, runs off. It was such a brief window for plants to get wet and respond in.
And what does that mean for you going forward?
Oh, well, we're not going to have a huge amount of grass, obviously, and despite very, very big stock losses, we haven't really got that much spare grass. We've got some, but we can't just go out and replace all of the stock that were lost.
You've not looked at restocking yet?
We're in the process of looking to purchase some more cattle.
You mentioned before about other people's generosity and indeed strangers turning up to come and help you out. Tell me a bit about that, Edwina. I might ask you a bit about that.
So we had a number of people turn up here to lend a hand. Patrick's first boss, when he first left school, came. Hadn't seen him since that time. We had a couple of gentlemen, one from Theodore and one from Warwick, whom we'd never met before, just rocked up with a backhoe and stayed with us for 2 weeks. They then turned around and went back down south, but they've been back up since helping other families and plan on coming back again. And it's just quite extraordinary that these people are just seeing something needs to be done and giving of their time so generously.
Patrick Hick, what did it mean to you?
It was quite uplifting, and we had some previous employees come back and help. They arrived basically uninvited, unannounced. They just turned up and started doing things. No, it's pretty uplifting when people like that give up their own time. We're talking about busy people. They've got their own stuff to do, and they stopped what they were doing, came and helped us. Quite uplifting.
Some of those jobs quite grisly in burying cattle and indeed fencing, kilometres and kilometres of fencing. That's a tough job. So to have other people come and stand beside you when you're doing that, that's something else.
It's not a fun job when you're doing it for yourself, let alone doing it for someone else. No, it was quite remarkable.
Patrick and Edwina, you were both away putting kids in boarding school when the rain was coming down. So obviously your kids weren't here at the time and probably luckily didn't see the disaster unfolding. But Edwina, I'll ask you, how have you helped your kids understand what's happened here? I mean, bush kids, they're so involved with what's happening on a station.
Well, it's actually been different for each of them. Obviously, Ella's a little bit older and more able to understand stuff and needs to be told the truth. Her big bullock, Rudolph, didn't survive, and so we had to tell her the bad news and that things here were pretty bad. Will, on the other hand, first year at boarding school, we decided to shelter him from everything, and I've just been feeding little bits of information to him over the holidays in chunks that he can understand and take on board.
And what's been their reaction? How have they coped in coming home?
Look, they've actually been fine, I think, because it's so hard for them to comprehend seeing things as they are now. You know, they haven't seen the bodies, they haven't seen the fences down, that's all been put away. You know, they haven't been able to comprehend what that could have been like. Now, they have been mustering and they've worked in the yards and that sort of thing, and obviously they're not seeing the numbers of cattle around that they would normally see and sort of questioning that a little bit. But other than that, it's sort of been business as usual.
Patrick Hick, where to from here? What will the rest of the year hold for you?
Finish our mustering, see what stock we do have left, so then we can start to sit down and draw up accurate budgets. And we've got to look at our business. We have not got the same business now that we did 3 months ago, so we've got to look at that. And then we've got other country that we've got to get in and get mustered. And it is, in some ways, it's we've got our usual year's program to get through, but we've got to be careful about what money we spend and what we do. We have to make some tough decisions in this business.
Patrick and Edwina Hick from Argyle near Julia Creek speaking with Arlie Felton-Taylor. And the Hicks have estimated their losses of cattle alone to be around the $6 million mark. Tasmania is on the cusp of a $2 billion investment in wind energy, $500 million of which is under construction. One of the major projects is on a beef property at Granville Harbour on the state's west coast. Farmer Royce Smith told Margot Kelly he's happy to see his paddocks become a construction site.
Yeah, I mean, I was first approached in 2003 about maybe a wind farm on the property, and to see where we're at now with the ground being broken and so much roadworks and employment on the place, it's great.
Royce Smith was instrumental in getting the wind project over the line. He's now sold his stake in the development, but remains landlord of the farm.
Yeah, so this is a pretty good financial incentives for us, and it's pretty well made it drought proof, if you could say that, even though we're probably one of the wettest farms in the Tasmania. But now I've been able to employ more people, and also we're improving the property with good fences and whatnot. So yeah, it's a big benefit for us.
The $280 million project will produce enough energy to power 46,000 homes. For Royce, it's diversified the farm, securing it for future generations.
I mean, I'm a third generation of the farm, and my father was, you know, involved in the early stages of the process. It means a lot because it's, you know, it's a family farm, and you know, we've been here since 1960, and we plan to keep going because it's a marvellous spot, and we are certainly putting some of the best beef out there.
While works are underway, Royce has reduced his stock numbers to 1,200 head.
So the cattle are used to it. I mean, they've been around machinery a long time, and there's a few more flashing lights and a bit more high vis these days, but yeah, no, they're fine.
Most mornings, Royce joins the construction team, helping ensure the wind farm project works alongside the beef operation.
So at the moment, while construction's underway, we've got a lot of temporary fencing up so we can just work around the construction footprint, and then ultimately in the end we will laneway the roadworks and the turbines out to where the cattle will pretty well graze nearly right up to the turbines.
While this property will soon be harvesting the wind, it's the West Coast's high average rainfall that makes it so attractive to grow grass and graze cattle.
So the season's been great. You know, it's probably not the best for construction. We've had a fair bit of rain here. We had 4 inches in February, which really kicked the grass in. So spring was great. So we got a lot of silage in the stock, and we're looking good for feed heading into winter.
Happy cattle?
Yeah, happy cattle. Keep them fed, and they're always happy. So.
The wind farm will be generating electricity by the end of the year. Project director Lyndon Frearson says the turbines will work any time the wind speed is above 18 kilometres per hour.
Based on our experience here thus far, I reckon it'll be every day of the year and twice on Sundays. It is very windy out here, and it's one of the highest capacity wind farms that I've worked on as far as how much wind we actually get and the consistency of that wind.
The towers will stand 200 metres tall from the base to the tip of the blade. The rich red volcanic soils that are so valued for growing lush grass are challenging for such large structures.
The bases of the turbines are about 700 cubic metres of concrete to hold the turbines down. And beneath those foundations, we then have 130 holes under each foundation to actually be able to stabilise the ground underneath the wind turbine.
The invaluable soil will be retained on farm and fill in steep slopes. Electricity generated at Granville Harbour will be connected to the Tasmanian network by a new 11-kilometre transmission line joining an existing connection point at hydropower dam, Rees Dam. State-owned Hydro Tasmania will buy the power and export most of it to the mainland market through an existing undersea cable. Energy analyst Mark White says transmission costs can make or break the economics of a wind farm.
Tasmania is in a good position. We've got one of the best wind resources in the world. The question for us is the cost of getting it into the Victorian market.
A feasibility study is underway into a second interconnector under Bass Strait. It's estimated to cost between $1.9 and $3.1 billion. A wind farm proposal of up to 1,000 megawatts for the state's northwest is contingent on this additional infrastructure.
In terms of the much bigger proposals, there's concerns that a $1 billion wind farm might need a $3 billion interconnector. So the economics are obviously very different.
The Granville Harbour wind farm cost around $10 million to connect to the grid. It's one of two projects under construction in the state. Another three are also on the cards, bringing the total investment in wind energy to over $2 billion. If they all come off, wind energy will make up a third of Tasmania's electricity generation.
Margot Kelly with our report there.